Okay, I'd like to introduce you to Ali, our second speaker.
It's all right now.
My name's Ali, I'm an addict. Thank you, Charlie, for that amazing build-up, no pressure. And it's kind of really good to be here, and let me just sort of keep an eye on the time. But thank you, Jay. And so this afternoon has been absolutely torturous. I went out and I did a meeting this morning. I had a commitment there and I sat and I listened to everybody else, and I've spoken to a couple of people this morning as well, and they were like, you know, just be. And then I went home and I tried very hard to just be, but my whole head was just tortured. It felt like somebody kind of scooped the top of my head off and just kind of opened it up. And then everything that I'd ever shared about, ever, was like just pouring through it. It's like, yeah, remember that bit. Oh, no, maybe not that bit. You know, and just on and on and on and on. And you know, what I have to remember is this is just a chair. You know, it's just a chair. There are 110 chairs here a year. You know, no drama. You know, it's not going to stop the tides. It's not going to, you know, cure, you know, some major disease. It's a chair by a woman that stopped using, you know. So, and it's just sort of given me an opportunity to just calm down a little bit, you know, just bring it down. I've got my protective wall up. I am a little bit OCD. So I've managed to build halfway across the table with a Costa, a Volvic and some chewing gum. And I have got a late edition of a Roundtree Street pastel, which is just giving me that extra edge. And I've also rearranged the key rings because nobody ever does them properly. And that's kind of a little bit about me, really. And I've also got on the most amazingly bright cardigan. So I'm a little bit bright and I'm a little bit perky. And I'm a bit of a fixture and fitting here, as somebody said to me the other day. You know, normally I'm at the back, you know, I kind of know where I am. I've got my little chair, it's kind of mine. And I sit here and I watch this unfold each week. And, you know, it's been a big part of my recovery for quite a while. And I sort of got asked to do the chair, and it was kind of like, oh, but it feels like I only did one a little while ago. You know, you can't possibly want me to do a chair again. And having been female chair finder here, I kind of know that sort of to get chairs in place isn't always easy. And so I could hardly say no when I got asked. And when I actually thought about it, the last time I did a chair here was about 2.5 years ago. So it's really good to kind of be sitting here. And I suppose I just sort of wanted to start. It's a 40-minute chair, and I'm not going to sort of give you a blow-by-blow account through my life. Well, I hope not, anyway. If I do, you know, perhaps someone can rein me in. But one thing I did think of is that when I came into NA, I very much came in from the cold. You know, I had quite a vulnerable childhood, and it kind of started fairly early, and I ended up with a kind of almost like a little sign on my head that kind of said vulnerable, and it got a little bit bigger every time something happened. And so what I used to do, by the time I got to about 11, 12, I would go and I would hide in the woods. And we weren't talking about hiding in the woods in the summer with like little deers sort of springing around. We were talking about it being freezing cold. Freezing cold, and the fog would kind of rise up. And I'd just be running from myself, you know, just trying to kind of keep myself safe. And it was freezing and it was cold. And I became a very morose, singular, insular child. And I kind of tried to blend in to the carpet, because just to go under the radar a little bit. And I just kind of held my ground for a while, I suppose. I just trod water, a bit like I did in my using, and I waited for the first opportunity that I could get to kind of get out of there. And, you know, I was a scapegoat, And that carried on outside of the family home. So I kind of got out of it when I was 16, and I sort of held all of this stuff till I got into recovery. I didn't think anybody else had ever had anything like that happen to them. I wasn't sure what to do with it, but when I got to about sort of 16, I was kind of off like a rocket. And I think with hindsight, I now know it's a disease of feelings, but I certainly didn't know that at the time. I just knew that I kind of had to press on and try and find some sort of anaesthetic. And I found that. I did quite well there. I found heroin, and I found that that was really good at containing everything. So I was able to kind of box it all off and just package it up and kind of just place it in there and carry on. You know, also, the morose kind of child that was very plain became a little bit of a looker in teenage years, so my whole kind of perception was changed, because suddenly I'd gone from victim to, you know, kind of the boot was on the other foot to an extent, and I just sort of trod myself around my teenage years, and I had some fun, you know, I was using, but I did have some fun, and you know, I went out and you know, and I went to gigs, and using was just something that was kind of a part of my life at that point. You know, it hadn't consumed it. It hadn't sort of taken me with the swell. I was still present, and I still had some choice as well, which was to go at later times. And I sort of think of my using as a bit like a kind of... it's a bit like a bouncing bomb. You know, it's almost like I had the ability to sort of lift myself out of situations. You know, I mean, I was a very flaky teenager. I was in and out of institutions, and possibly it was kind of like one of the longest suicides in history before I got here. You know, it just kept rolling and rolling. And I sort of decided that the thing to do after having been in an institution and having some drug problems, it's kind of obvious, is that you should have a child. You know, that seemed like, you know, well, you didn't have a very good childhood, Ali, so do you know what we're going to do? We're going to just replace it. You're going to have a child, and he's going to be adorable, and you are going to be able to give yourself to that child and bring, you know, bring him up and love him and nurture him. And that's what I did. I became pregnant very quickly, and I had my son, Josh. And, you know, I was scripted. You know, I'm an 80s junkie. You know, it's a bit like kind of woo for the olders. I got in here middle-aged, and I was an 80s junkie. It was kind of the times of, you know, Just Say No, which I blatantly didn't. And the other one was Heroin Screws You Up. And I spent a great deal of my time proving that that wasn't the case. You know, it's like, well, you know what? If you can't handle it, don't use it, you know. But I was scripted and I was a nuisance. You know, I was an effing nuisance. You know, I was the one sitting in doctors begging and pleading with stories, you know, and... It was horrific fairly early on. You know, I had a son. It wasn't my kind of life story that I really wanted, you know, to be stratospheric, but I certainly don't think that I wanted to use for, you know, most of my adult life and kind of drag everyone around in the maelstrom. You know, Josh's dad had gone to prison, and I was kind of left on my own. And, you know, the getting and finding ways, you know, to use more is exactly what I did. I was quite inventive. I was willing to give anything a go. And that's, you know, that's how it went. And I kind of bounced between poverty and, you know, it's okay. And then I'd be back down again. And then it would kind of... It was like the bouncing bomb in the Dam Busters or whatever. It's like, do, 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 you know, and it kind of bounces about three times. And it took a long while until I smashed into the wall. It took years, you know. And in the meantime, I was kind of bringing up my son and sort of all of the things that I hadn't liked about my childhood, although they were different circumstances, my son was getting a raw deal. And I remember sort of one particular time sort of coming up, I was in the criminal justice system, and, you know, I'd been very convincing to the judge, you know, about why I shouldn't be put into prison. It's because, you know, my son, don't you understand? It's my son. I need to look after my son. And basically what that translated as in my head is, please don't put me in prison because I will find it harder to use. You know, and I love my son. I love my son with all my heart. You know, my son is an adult now, but that's not enough when my son is young to stop me shutting the front door when he's asleep and walking away and going somewhere else to pick up drugs and legging it back around those flats and hairing in the door just to know that my son's still asleep. You know, all of the things that could have happened to him, you know, there could have been a fire, somebody could have discovered him, he could have got out. All of those things could have happened. However, you know, put drugs in the equation and I'm going to do more or less anything. You know, the relief when I used to get in that door. But it was short-lived because moments later, I'd be using. You know, I'd just be getting down to using. And there were a variety of godfathers that were in my son's life, all of which I'd had a relationship with before, during and after. So it's kind of like my son was kind of well looked after and I had a kind of coterie of men around. And one of them actually became my husband because the sort of 80s scene was quite interchangeable. So the men were sort of changing and their roles were changing as well. You know, they could be godfathers and then they could be husbands and they could be husbands or they could be lovers. You know, and that's kind of how it went because I had a massive need for validation. And that didn't go away throughout my using because, in fact, the longer I used and the more impact that had on my life, the more I needed you to tell me that I was okay. I don't think I ever actually felt it when someone said it, but I believe that was the answer. You know, just tell me I'm okay. You know? And that's kind of how it went. You know, it sounds pretty horrific, doesn't it? Let's move it on a little. You know, I mean, one of the godfathers became my husband. And the reason that he became my husband, or one of them anyway, in 1990, was because I got him through his accountancy exams with a large amount of methadone. So he was he was very grateful. And I kind of used with that man from when I was 17. So he was around, he was Josh's godfather. 10 years later, he's my husband. You know, that's kind of the way that we rolled. And my son was getting older. You know, and the consequences were racking up. You know, I don't intend to kind of talk much longer about my using because there's nothing very dramatic about it. Now, that might sound a bit bizarre when I just mentioned some of the things that I have, but my using wasn't, hey, rock and roll, you know. I kind of wanted sedation, and I found it, and I was determined to hang on to it by hell or high water, because I just didn't want to feel. I really didn't want to feel. I wasn't keen on it. I had no experience of it, but please don't bring the feeling anywhere near me, you know, because I'm just going to escalate and I'm just going to run with it. And my son grew into a man while I used, you know, and he left just like I'd left at 16. But he did come back, and you know, I talked about sort of bashing into the wall. You know, the end of my using again, there was nothing glorious about it. You know, I was a husk of a woman that had used for a long time and had a lot of consequences, and the role reversal of my son at the end of my using was pitiful. You know, my son was trying to keep me alive. He was trying to feed me. Like a baby. You know, I had It's a feeling then. I was so skinny, and I was in such a bad way. And the most amazing thing was that, you know, I was actually on a sheepskin kind of thing on my bed because I was so thin, and I was so ill. And I still sort of, you know, even a few months before that, you know, my using, it wasn't large amounts towards the end, you know, but I had no idea what to do. I just didn't want to be there anymore. And I had some bizarre notion that as long as I didn't take my own life, it was okay. You know, that's the kind of insanity that sort of ran through my mind. And my son adored me, you know, and I remember he'd kind of used to go out in the morning and he'd come back. And I would have done nothing, because at the end of my using, I wasn't doing anything. I was scripted. I had a few bits and pieces coming in. That was it. It was kind of one-way traffic, you know, pyjama bottoms and coat over the top. And also, as well, I'd moved out to the arse of nowhere in an attempt to kind of persuade other people. Who knows that I still kind of had something going on. I've got no idea, really, looking back, what I thought I was doing. You know, so that was it. You know, it's a husk of a woman, a grown-up son, an addicted husband in the middle of nowhere. You know, and I got given a break via a doctor. You know, my doctor had known me for years. And I think I was mightily surprised when she turned round one day and sort of said, Ali, you need detox. You know, I wasn't an addict that had kind of bounced in and out of rehabs. I'd never really wanted recovery. I think once when she'd mentioned it before, I was kind of like, you mental? You know what? Give up all of this? Sure? There is another way? It's like, you can't be serious. You know, all of the carnage, but I couldn't see it. You know, I just couldn't see a hand in front of my face, to be fair. You know, and I think by the time I got into recovery, I'd kind of dug a hole so big, I kind of just wasn't really sure where to go with it. And I quite sort of accepted what was coming, or what I thought was coming, because I didn't think there would ever, ever be a chance of me getting clean. You know, I accepted my lot. I had no notion of detoxes or treatment centres. And NA to me was just this poster that used to be in my prescribing clinic. I had no idea what you all did here. Didn't really want to know, because I'm okay, thank you. Do you know what I mean? It was just mind-blowing, really. So let's lift this into recovery. I kind of jumped through the window of opportunity, and I ended up in a detox, and that was kind of the start for part two of my life. And I sat in that detox for... they asked me, what kind of detox do you want to do? And they mentioned one. They said, oh, it makes your blood pressure drop quite a bit, and it makes you sleepy. I said, I'll have it, thank you. And my home life was actually so bad by then that I was the woman that went on weekend leave at 7 weeks or something and was banging on the detox door after about a morning. I think I went and got my hair done and then I was back. You know, there was no heating. Our whole house was just trashed. It was abysmal. So there I was sitting in this detox, and for the first time like ever, I saw some people that were clean, and they came in. You know, I'm a very bouncy individual. I sort of wanted to do this in order because I'm such a perfectionist, but one thing that anybody that knows me will know is that I'm a very kind of bouncy individual that's quite smiley and wants to kind of say hello. And and just kind of wants to know, you know, what's going on a bit. Some people might say it's nosy, but but I'm also well up for kind of just finding out what goes on in people's lives. And a lot of that is to do with the fact that when I did arrive in NA, I got given some real TLC. Mm. You know, I got a little bit of it in treatment. But, you know, I was like Mad Meg of Shoreditch when I got into recovery. You know, I looked like a bag lady. I was kind of... I know you find that hard to believe. She said, milking for compliments. But it was so not a good look. You know, it was so not a good look. I was skinny as anything. And I'm told I was actually quite angry as well. Although, again, I don't think I was that angry. But, you know... just actually having my eyes open. I was kind of, I suppose I was a bit like Sleeping Beauty, but like when I woke up, I didn't look very princess-like, you know, but my eyes were open, and that was a big result. You know, even that my eyes were open, just to drink in what was going on, just around me, it was like the most amazing world had been going on without me. And then suddenly there I was, taking part in it. And the people that kind of came into that detox, you know, one of them in particular had kind of tattoos, squeaky clean hair, he drove, and he didn't use. I mean, you know, what more could you want? It was a revelation. And also that people would not only kind of say hello to me, they'd also listen to all my nonsense, because I became... I was queen of being a nurse, really, in the detox. And one thing I noticed and that I've discovered now, but probably didn't recognise so much at the time, was that within 5 minutes of being in a detox, we'd go in group and I would hear people talk about very painful experiences. And I became Nurse Ali, because I found it, I didn't really want to acknowledge my pain. It was like, yours was more relevant, yours was more important, you know, and I can still struggle with that even now. It was like, you know, I'm in therapy at the moment, and I've had therapy on and off in recovery, and it is about just acknowledging myself, you know, and my journey. But the one person that was able to witness me coming into recovery was my adorable Josh. You know, he was 22 when I got into recovery. And, you know, that's a long time. That's a long time. And I never, sort of, when I started out, thought that I would be, you know, having a man come to visit me. You know, my son was a man. But it was... NA didn't just kind of give me support and love. You know, it gave my son that too. And for the first time, like, ever, he had a mum that was actually there. You know, love is kind of, you know, love, great. You know, but I wasn't really able to show him just how much I cared, you know, until I got into recovery. And some sort of... amazing things happened. You know, I started to get some key rings, you know, and I'd give my son, every time I got a key ring, I will put some extra money in the pot, NA. My son got another key ring as well. You know, it was kind of, this is my 30 days, this is my 60. They were really fucking precious. I just swore. Me now. They were really precious. You know, they're just plastic, but they were just the most amazing things ever. You know, I kind of wanted the set. You know, I had my eye on the prize, a bit like a bag of gear. I kind of wanted the set. And I set about it in a big, styly way. I remember I probably, if any of you were in treatment at the same time as me, and you wanted to use when you came out at the other end, I was probably really pissed you off. Because I was kind of like queen of NA. You know, I did meetings, 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 meetings. I met people, I got loved, you know, and I just kept going. And my son went to a gig with a friend of his, And she was mighty curious about one of the key rings that he had. And she was like, "Are you taking the piss? Where'd you get that from?" It's his neck in a lager. I don't know what particular... I can't remember now sort of what time scale it was. But it was there, and it was waving. And they asked him, and they challenged him. And he said, "It's my mum's." And he told her who I was, and she knew me. It was, like, fantastic. You know, I actually was taking part in life, you know. And that was so amazing for him, you know. And he kind of witnessed me get my year as well at Brixton. You know, Brixton was a big part of my recovery. I can't believe I've been talking for 25 minutes and I'm still in early recovery. You know, my son saw me pick up my year, you know, and that was to be given, you know, just to be able to give him that experience, and for NA to be able to carry both of us, because I am quite clever sometimes, and I am going to try and weave him in and out of this chair, okay? So that was amazing, the fact that I had a year up. You know, I was 45 year old when I got that key ring. 45 years old, and I've never looked back. You know, I've continued to kind of stay in NA. I'm just going to have a sip of my water now. I hope that's all right. Right. I think I still love recovery because I love what I can get here. And it gives me the ability to be very different. But I've kind of been a slow burner in some respects. You know, I came into recovery with a host of consequences, and I was an IV user. And in the 80s, you know, I was, you know, harm in wasn't really about, you know. So I had a host of bloodborns. I had Hep B when I was 20. That had given me liver damage. I'd got non-A, non-B, as it was called then, at the same time. And I also became HIV positive, and I became it quite early on in the grand scheme of things. You know, and so there was lots to kind of be worked on. Again, I'd boxed all of this stuff up, and the first time I heard someone mention their diagnosis in here, I was, you know, I was just like, thank you. You know, just thank you. You know, I could kind of bring anything to NA. And I can't think of anything that I've experienced in NA that I haven't heard someone share about. You know, not yet, anyway. I guess there's always time, but not yet. You know, I am also what's known... I found out yesterday, and I've got to read this from my notes because I want to get it right. I am now called an elite controller, which sounds like some sort of spy thing, doesn't it? Or, you know, something to do with railways. In fact, I fall, but not a fat controller, all right? Which kind of sounds pretty scientific. And that is because I fall into 1% of people with HIV that... do not require medication and have contained the virus. So I'm a very lucky girl. But one thing that used to piss me off and still can to an extent, and I think, shall I say it, shan't I say it, you know, this stuff is chance. You know, I'd sometimes hear people share in NA that there, but for the grace of God, I didn't get this or I didn't get that. You know, it's kind of, you know, I took the risks, and I did. End of story. You know, it's nothing to do with me having a second-rate higher power. I did it, and I got it, you know. But having said that, being in recovery has given me, you know, a chance to kind of try and look after myself, you know. And to kind of relish life itself. But when I kind of first got here, and I said it's been a slow journey, it's, you know, I was the first person to run away from the Croatian Convention. I went there, I was about a year clean, and I thought I was mended in some respects, but not others. And it was boiling hot. I remember absolutely baking hot. I still had no boobs. I dressed in black, had skinny jeans on and a pair of Converse, and I never took those jeans off the whole time. I remember people in recovery, it's almost like those glossy images of kind of people on the beach, kind of throwing beach balls, you know, and there was I. I was so crippled with self-obsession and the fact that I had scars and, you know, it's like, oh, no. You know, and I just remember just being hugely uncomfortable in my own skin. You know, I'd engaged with a sponsor. You know, I had a higher power. You know, I did step work, but some of this stuff takes as long as it takes. And I got to, it was only on for about, I think it was 4 days, 3 days. Well, I got to day two and I knew I was out of there. And it seemed like a really good thing was to book a cab at midnight, go to the airport with one day to go. I only had to sit it out 24 hours. And that was my level of discomfort. I needed to get back to somewhere that I felt comfortable in. And it was like almost like a kind of wolf's lair. And I trod the streets of London where I knew. And I sat in my flat. And I don't think I've ever been so happy to kind of walk through the door of my flat as coming back. You know, almost punch the air, you know, as I walk through the door. Don't let that put anyone off going, though. They'd never forgive me. So, yeah, you know, there was a lot of work to be done, you know, and all the way through, you know, my kind of son has been there as well, and we've kind of done various journeys along the way. I stayed, and life happened, you know, and I've not had the best couple of years in recovery, you know. Things have happened, but they've also enabled me to really kind of step up to the mark in some respects. You know, I spoke about my husband, and when I came into recovery, we couldn't be together, because even though Trevor had kind of come to NA and seen it, he decided that it wasn't for him, and he didn't want to stop using. You know, and if you don't want to stop using, you don't want to stop using. You know, he was incredibly proud of me and the life that I'd made. But he didn't want to stop using, and our contact kind of dwindled over time. And, you know, their phone calls dropped off a little bit. I think he was embarrassed. Well, I know he was embarrassed. You know, he kind of seen me stop and done something that he wasn't ready to do. And he ended up moving to Wales, and our lives were completely separate. But I got a phone call off him, which was kind of real understatement stuff, where he said, I'm not very well, Ali. I'm not very well. As he said, I'm a little bit poorly. And I said, do you know what? I'm kind of coming for you. I'm going to help you. You know, I'm going to come down. I had a good enough network of people around me and people on the phone. Trevor was still using, and he lives in the middle of Wales. But it was okay, because I was able to go, you know. And just before I was going to leave to go, I got another phone call from him, which said, Ali, I'm dying. I have cancer. And it's, you know, I don't have very long. You know, I don't have very long to live. Now, this was a woman that couldn't cope with anything without a bag of gear. But I said, I'm going to come. And I'm going to come down and it's going to be okay. And we filled that man up, sort of me and my son. We kind of took that man out of Wales with his love of music and his love of art that hadn't been touched in years. And we brought him down to London and we took him out. You know, my son took him to vinyl shops. My husband just, oh, his love of music was huge. And his knowledge was huge as well. And I took him out to the Tate Modern. And as long as we were able to, I travelled to Wales and he came down to us and stayed in London. And there's so much more I wanted to say, and I can't believe this because I've done kind of 34 minutes. I got the message that my husband had become unconscious and it was time to go down there. And I kind of just did it in kind of bite-sized pieces. I sat with his sister in the hospital and we were there for 5 days. Because Trevor was a fairly young man in the grand scheme of things. So I had kind of 2-hour breaks because they said he's going to go at any time. I think it was his love of opiates that kind of kept him going. Wasn't quite prepared to let go until he got his, you know, as much as he could, I think. I had people on the phone that I was able to call and I was there. I held his hand and I said to him, do you know what? You're going to be okay. You are going to be okay. And I was with him when he died. And I was able to be an ambassador for that man with his family. I was able to keep his privacy. I dealt with his sister. This was a woman that thought she couldn't do intimacy, still thinks she can't do intimacy. And yet I dealt with all of that. And he had a humanist service, and I chose the music, and it was just so amazing. And he had a kind of wicker coffin and wildflowers, and it took place in Wales, and it was like really rural. And my son and me were there, and we kind of held each other. You know, and I'm going to sort of, I've got 5 minutes to wrap it up, and you know, I've kind of carried on in recovery, and the kind of 80s junkie that was the nuisance in the doctor surgeries has kind of changed. Some of it seems to me like it's very slow, but in fact the most immense changes have been made. And my life is a very kind of gentle life today. You know, I wanted to tell you a bit about my grandmother because I've kind of got a couple of photos here of my dad. But basically, to kind of square the circle, I went back to where I was born a few weeks ago. And I hadn't been there since I was 8. And it contained the house where I was born and my grandmother. Yeah, and I suppose this kind of does square the circle in some respects. Out of the blue, on a really beautiful sunny day, I decided that I was going to go, and I was going to go on my own. And I walked the streets where I'd grown up until I was about 7. And my parents aren't around. So everything that I do in here for clarity is putting bits of the jigsaw together. Only I can do it. I have to look for the clues. And there was something that had never come up in my step work, and it was my grandmother. I absolutely adored my grandmother. She was like something out of the 1930s. You know, she kind of fed me kind of Famel's cough medicine and Andrew's liver salts as lemonade. And she was my, you know, Diana, you know, Princess Diana used to talk about her rock. You know, that was my grandmother. My grandmother shielded me from quite a harsh environment. And as I walked around these streets, there was blossom, it was beautifully warm, and it was just comforting. I sat in the park and I kind of took it all in, and I thought, I'll never find these places, but I did. And I kind of sat in front of my grandmother's house, and I came home at the end of it, and I went through some papers and I found a funeral card for my grandmother. My grandmother, I didn't even know what her name was, but why would I? My grandmother was called Emily. And I found this card and it put the massive piece of the jigsaw together, because I realised that year when I was 7, my grandmother had died My mother had lost her hair. I had an abusive father. I had a best friend that lived next door. My granddad had had a stroke and was paralysed. And suddenly, I got lifted out of this sepia environment, which was like 1930s England. And I'd just been dropped, traumatised, into a completely different environment. And do you know, for that... That afternoon, as I look through those, and there's a picture of my dad standing in front of the house where I went, but it was amazing that while I walked around, I got a real sense of compassion for me that had never surfaced in my step work until then. But it's like, whoa, all that happened in the space of what? You know, so I'm going to wrap it up because I've done 40 minutes, which is quite amazing. I haven't even finished my coffee. do you know, I just wanted to kind of say, I suppose that I never thought I would get clean, and I certainly never felt that I would be in a position to have a message to give anybody about how to not use drugs. And, you know, so it's been a real privilege to kind of be here, and thank you for letting me share.